Good morning. I would like to call to order the December 1st, 2021 Technical Advisory Committee meeting. The Palm Beach TPA is conducting this meeting both in person and virtually using the Zoom webinar platform. Instruction to join the virtual meeting as well as contact information for assistance are provided in the published meeting agenda. Staff, please call the roll so that we can establish a quorum.
I'm switching microphones. Maybe that'll help because I don't hear the echo anymore. So at this time, I'm only asking those TAC members attending in person to respond by saying here when I call your name. And I want to remind you to unmute your microphones. There's a button on the base. And when the light is on top, on it's red, it means that you're live and the virtual attendees can hear you. Alternates, please also state your name if you are attending on behalf of a TAC representative. Jim Bell, Maria Tahara.
Here.
Gary Dunmire.
Here.
Richard Pereira.
Here.
Kenny Wilson.
Here.
Thomas Driscoll. Jamie Brown. Natalie Crowley.
Here.
Kim Glass Castro.
Ms. Cabrera, on behalf of Kim.
Thank you. And if you guys can just bring your microphones closer so I can pick it up on the recording. Gary Sipek.
Here.
Ryan Davis.
Present.
Levi McCollum.
Present.
Aaron Hoffman.
Here.
Terrence Bailey. Christopher Marsh. Joyce Here. Kai.
Hello.
Lorraine Cargill. Kim Delaney.
Here.
Michael O'Dell will be absent. Alex Hansen.
Here.
Kevin Volberg.
Present.
John Crane.
Here.
Moda Samalturk. Kara Ferris.
Here.
We have a quorum in person, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Next is modifications to the agenda. Staff, are there any modifications to the agenda?
Yes, Madam Chair. The following members are requesting TAC permission to participate remotely. We have Vice Chair Moda Samalturk from Palm Beach County Engineering, noted that the county is still limiting in-person meeting allowance. Jamie Brown from Lake Worth Beach has a meeting conflict at City Hall at 10:30. Joyce Kai from the school district is still experiencing staff shortages and is unable to attend in person. Kim Delaney is here, so I don't need to note her absence. Jim Bell from Boca Raton noted the city is still limiting in-person meeting allowance. And Christopher Marsh from Royal Palm Beach has a conflicting medical appointment.
TAC members, are there any objections to allowing these members to participate remotely? Seeing or hearing none, these members are approved to participate remotely. Margie, please note their attendance in the minutes.
And I do have one other modification, Madam Chair. We did have an additional item that was revised in the agendas on your dais, the ones we provided for you under Action item 2C related to the Atlantic Avenue widening project. There was some missing language in the agenda description that differed from the resolution we provided to you all. So we wanted to correct that. And the addition is shown as an underline. We also posted the revised version on our website. So if anyone's watching and they re-download it, it'll show it as well.
Okay.
And then Connor will review that during his presentation.
Okay. Do I need a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Motion to approve the minutes for October 6, 2021. Are there any changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
I make a motion to approve the minutes as presented.
I'll second.
I have a motion from Alex Hansen and a second by Levi McCollum. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, moving on. General public comments and public comments on agenda items. As a reminder, there are three ways to provide public comment for this meeting. Written comments may be submitted online at the website provided in the agenda. Verbal comments may be made by virtual attendee using the raise hand feature in the Zoom platform. Verbal and written comments may be provided by an in-person attendee submitting a comment card available at the welcome table. Staff, have any general comments been received?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, next agenda item, comments from the chair and the member comments. I have no comments from the chair, but at this time I would like to invite any TAC members comments on items not already on the agenda. For members participating remotely, please utilize the raise hand feature in the Zoom platform, and then remember to unmute your microphone once you recognize. And in-house, we've been using the raise card function to be acknowledged for comment. Do we have any raised hands?
No, Madam Chair, and I do not see that any tent cards have been raised either.
Okay, thank you. TAC liaison report.
Hey, this is James Bell. I do have a raised hand somehow. It's not, I clicked on it. It didn't, it's not showing it.
I'm sorry, Jim. So I do have Jim Bell then.
Jim?
I just have a question on item 2C. I was just wondering if that item, this is for either staff or for the chair, if that item was heard by the Pedestrian Bicycle Advisory Board, because I think it would be really good for the TAC to have heard what their vote was and their recommendation on the item. And I would think that because it could have implications on future pedestrian bicycle design on other roadways in the county, I'd kind of like to know how what their position is on that particular item.
Sure, Connor Campobasso, Broward, Palm Beach CVA.
Come on, Connor.
I'm sorry. So 2C was pulled back in October during the TAC meeting to allow the TPA staff to work with DOT a little bit further to kind of refine that resolution. The resolution is also going to the BTPAC for their input as well and recommendation to the board. So we'll be getting their input on that resolution, and then from there we'll go on to the board for a final approval.
So we don't have their recommendations yet then, obviously. They're looking at the same time we are.
Correct. Yeah. So they'll be looking at it tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. Next is the TAC liaison report. I'd like to invite Connor to provide an update.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you all here in person. I do have a few items I'd like to highlight here today. So the first, as you all are probably aware by now, but the current executive director, Nick Uren, is resigning effective January 28th. And the newly formed TPA Executive Committee will be meeting to recommend the governing board a recruitment firm to administer the process of selecting a new executive director. The committee will also recommend an interim executive director. The meeting will be held on December 6 at 10 a.m., both in person and virtually. To view the agenda packet details, please visit palmbeachtpa.org/board. And to watch the meeting live, you can take a look at the website palmbeachtpa.org/live. The next item, FDOT invites you to participate in a live webinar presenting the draft CIS policy update plan. The CIS network is Florida's high priority transportation facilities important to the state's economy and mobility. The webinar will take place on December 9th at 10 a.m. and the link to the webinar registration can be found at fdot.gov/planning/systems. The 2022 Safe Street Summit will be held February 17th through the 18th at the Intercontinental Hotel in downtown Miami. The theme for 2022 is resilient and adaptive streets. The focus on collaborations to build a regional vision of safe, equitable, multimodal transportation systems that adapt to community needs and enables both flourishing now and in the future. To register, visit safestreetsummit.org. On December 4th, the TPA is launching its second virtual public workshop for the Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7 Multimodal Corridor Study. The workshop will provide the public an opportunity to evaluate transit and roadway alternatives along the Okeechobee and State Road 7 corridor, and provide feedback on how we can plan for a more safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. For more information, visit palmbeachtpa.org/OKEE. And last, I'm going to kind of skip down to the bottom here for number 10. FDOT hosted a statewide challenge called Love to Ride Florida to get more people bicycling from the for the month of November. Almost 200 workplaces logged over 300,000 miles on their bikes for the month. Local organizations with multiple participants include the Palm Beach TPA, the Village of Palm Springs, City of West Palm Beach, and FDOT District 4. For more information on the Love to Ride Challenge, you can visit lovetoride.net/Florida. And that is all I have for today. There is some additional items in the liaison report, so that's been attached in the backup if you'd like to review. Thank you.
Thank you. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair. However, I do have Jim Bell with his hand raised.
Okay, Jim.
Oh, sorry about that. No, that was pertaining to the previous item I spoke. Sorry.
It's okay. I have Natalie with her tent card raised.
Natalie. Oh, thanks. I just want to take a moment, since it was raised in the liaison report, to express just some brief words to the executive director who is resigning. And I just want to take a moment, I don't think he's here, to say what an honor it's been working with him during his time here at the TPA. Nick has been just incredible, taking this TPA and elevating it to a different level, and his passion and his dedication toward mobility. And he's a visionary and he is a great leader, and I wish him all the best.
Thank you, Natalie.
And I will note for the members, Nick is participating virtually, so he was able to hear your comments. Thank you, Natalie.
Do any other committee members have any comments or questions on the liaison report? Great, thank you. Let's move on. Action items: motion to elect officers for the 2022 calendar year. Pursuant to section 3.3.B of the TPA's operating procedures, the officers shall be elected annually at the last regularly scheduled meeting of the calendar year. The newly elected officers shall take office at the first regularly scheduled meeting of the following year. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. First, I would like to open the floor to nominations for the chair and let everyone know that I am willing to continue to serve in this capacity. Are there any other nominations? Natalie, I see you have a card up.
I make a motion for Kara Ferris to remain as chair.
Second.
I have Mo with his hand raised.
Okay. Mo.
Thank you. And thank you for allowing me to participate remotely. I have a motion to nominate Gary Dunmire for the chair.
Mo, to be clear, I have that you wanted Gary Dunmire as the chair?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm not sure if there's any other nominations, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm seeing no other tent cards raised and no other hands raised virtually. So if Gary is willing to serve as chair, we can do a hand raise vote, and I can do a roll call vote, since we do have quite a few members virtually. And then each member can cast their vote, and we'll do the chair first and then the vice chair second.
Okay. Do they need a second?
No, normally nominations for officers don't require a second.
Okay, perfect.
So Gary, if you're okay with the nomination, we can move forward with...
No, I'd rather not serve.
You're declining the nomination? Okay. So, Madam Chair, since Gary is declining, you can ratify yourself as the chair. And then at the end, once we do the vice chair, we can take a final motion to ratify them both.
Okay, so move on to the
Vice chair.
Okay. Second, I would like to open the floor to nominations for the vice chair. Moal Turk, you are the current vice chair. Are you willing to continue to serve in this capacity?
Thank you, madam. Yeah, sure. If the group wants me to serve, support that, certainly.
Are there any other nominations?
I don't have any tent cards up and no virtual hands raised.
Okay, we'll close nominations. Okay, finally, I'm seeking a motion to elect Kara Ferris as a chair and Moal Turk as the vice chair. Hearing no further discussion, I guess, do I need a motion?
Yes, if we can just ratify it with a motion, please.
Madam Chair, I make a motion to elect Kara Ferris as chair and Moal Turk as vice chair.
Second.
Hearing no further discussion, I have a motion by Natalie Crowley and a second by Alex Hansen. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to B, motion to recommend adoption of amendment number 2 to the TPA's fiscal year FY22-26 Transportation Improvement Program. I'd like to invite Jason Price, TPA TIP coordinator, to present this item.
Good morning, everyone. Today I'll be presenting amendment number 2 to the Transportation Improvement Program for fiscal year 22 through 26. This amendment number 2 is a request by FDOT to modify one project and add a new project to the Transportation Improvement Program. And so before I get into the projects themselves, just want to review when a TIP amendment is needed. And there are certain actions that trigger an amendment for a Transportation Improvement Program. And that is when a project is added or deleted, which is happening here. Also, if the cost increases more than 20% and $2 million, there's a change in the scope of work, or there's a change in the project phase or initiation date, which is happening here as well to the second project. And as always, projects that are listed in the amendment are the only projects that are impacted by voting for this amendment. There is a collection of other projects in the Transportation Improvement Program that are not impacted by this amendment. So no other project in the TIP are affected. Only the projects that are listed in the amendment are impacted by voting on this amendment today. So jumping into covering the first project, that is I-95 at PGA Boulevard. And the proposed action here is to advance this project from fiscal year 2024 to 2022. And the reasoning is the advancement of these funds. There's a new funding source that came on board for FDOT. It's ARPA, and that is the, let's see, American Rescue Plan Act is a new funding source that came online in March 1st. And so FDOT was able to program some of those funds on this particular project and advance it a couple of years. So that resets the phase date. So that triggers the amendment for this particular project. The next project you've seen before in previous months when we adopted this particular TIP document, a project was pulled, I-95 at Boynton Beach Boulevard. This project was pulled to further work with FDOT and Boynton Beach and the TPA to work on some of the bicycle and pedestrian improvements and kind of harmonize those between adjacent projects on both sides, on both ends of this particular project. So that coordination has happened. They've come to an agreement for the bicycle and pedestrian improvements. And so it's being brought back here as a new project to be reintroduced into the TIP document. I have a few slides here to show you exactly how the project kind of lays out with the other two projects and to kind of show the continuity. From the west, you see there's a pointing our project, our resurfacing project to the west, and then the project in the middle, the I-95 Boynton Beach Boulevard project, is the one being discussed today. And you see some of the elements for the buffered bike lane and the sidewalk, and trying to maintain continuity with the project to the west. And then going further east, there's another project, a shared use project, a shared use path project to the east. And so this project is in between, and it's, they found a way to kind of harmonize it and make some and establish continuous facilities through Boynton Beach Boulevard. And so with that, those are the two projects. If there's any questions, I can answer them at this time.
Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, I need a motion to recommend adoption of amendment number 2 to the TPA's fiscal year 2022-2026 TIP, and then I will open the floor to discussion.
Motion to adopt.
Second.
Sorry, who's the second? Thank you. Okay, now I'll open the floor to discussion. Do we have any?
You do have two tent cards raised, and I don't have virtual hands raised at this time.
Okay, Alex, let's start with you.
Yeah, I just had a question. If you had a little bit more detail on the PGA at I-95 project, because I see the description just mentions that this is to add a special use lane, an auxiliary lane. But I was just a little bit, I was just curious as to what that exactly meant. I actually moved to that area a few months ago, so I have special interest in on this project.
Yes. I have reached out. I'm going to reach out to FDOT to find out exactly the nature of that. Do you have any additional details on what?
I don't, but maybe during the course of the meeting, I'll reach out via email and see if I can get the description.
Just curious whether this was adding capacity. What is the nature of that auxiliary lane?
I'd be happy to chime in.
I was wondering if
I may. The City of Palm Beach Gardens has been tracking and working with DOT on this project, which has been approved as part of the TIP for several years now. So it was funded in 2024. And what it's doing on that southbound ramp, if you're going southbound off of PGA onto 95, there's congestion that occurs on the ramp. So the improvement includes reducing the merge that occurs once you get off that ramp and adding an additional receiving lane, basically an auxiliary lane. And that is supposed to, and hopefully will, address the congestion that occurs on the ramp, primarily PM, 5 PM-ish. It's really, really bad.
But this is exclusively kind of on the receiving end.
It's an exclusive receiving lane going on, yes, going southbound, and it's an exclusive receiving lane. And then I think eventually that it will merge, but that quite a ways down. So it's adding it is adding capacity, and it's going to reduce that merge, and it's going to free up the congestion that occurs on that southbound ramp.
Okay, so the work is primarily on the I-95.
Yes.
Because after you leave that ramp, if you're coming from the east.
Yes.
Okay.
And from my understanding, it's completely in the right of way.
And Palm Beach Gardens, I assume, is supportive of this project.
Yes, we're very supportive.
Thank you.
My comment, if I may, Madam Chair, is just to thank the DOT for accelerating this project. We've been advocating it. It was once combined with an interchange improvement. It was spun off exclusive. It was spun off to accelerate this. And so I just wish to express the city's gratitude in accelerating this project. Thank you.
Sorry, Margie, who are the other comments? Are they online?
No, you had Natalie and Alex. I don't see any other tent cards raised, and no virtual attendees raise their hands.
Okay, hearing no further discussion, I have a motion by Natalie and a second by Aaron Hoffman. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Okay, thank you very much. Next is motion to recommend adoption of a resolution affirming TPA support for the Atlantic Avenue widening project from Florida's Turnpike to Jog Road. Connor, you're going to make a presentation on this item?
I am, yes. So if you all remember, you did see a presentation from DOT back in October regarding the Atlantic Avenue project. It was deferred to allow TPA staff to work with DOT a little bit more to refine that. There was a couple main concerns, which I'll go through during this presentation. I'll also give a little recap on kind of where we're at today. So I did want to start off first by going over what the board's recommendation was, and that was to move forward with a shared use pathway. They saw the on-street bike lanes as undesirable for a situation where it's six lanes at 45 miles an hour. They also recommended to remove the partially displaced left turn as an option due to, it was mainly right-of-way impacts, but they also expressed some concerns about access to the local businesses, as well as pedestrian bicyclist safety. It also creates an alignment where it might violate drivers' expectations, and they had some concerns about that as well. They did acknowledge, however, that the dual left and the triple left options, they might not meet LOSD at peak hours in 2045, and they seem to be okay with that, just given the fact that they had those concerns, especially with the right-of-way and the pedestrian safety. During our TAC discussion, there was some concerns with the resolution itself, sort of locking DOT into a typical section for a PD&E study and didn't allow them the flexibility to develop the best option possible. There was also some concerns with the elimination on the on-street bikes facility, mainly because that on-street bike facility also creates a shoulder, and it also doesn't provide a facility for riders that prefer to ride on the roadway. The TAC did not acknowledge during the meeting that it's unlikely to fit the full DOT FDM spec shared use pathway along with a on-street bike facility, given the right-of-way impacts. In addition to the typical section, there was two other comments. One was regarding the displaced left turns. There was some support for that during the TAC discussion. Another item that was pretty heavily discussed was the inclusion of shade trees in the swale, if possible. We did speak with FDOT regarding this. The landscaping can be part of a future project, but the TPA staff is going to have to work with DOT a little bit more regarding funding options for that future project, but it will have to be a separate project in the future. But it is, again, it's still an option, so we're going to be exploring that. So finally, that leaves us with the resolution language, which I have on the screen for you here. We worked with DOT quite a bit on this resolution language, and we think it provides that flexibility that everybody was looking for, especially regarding the typical section itself, as well as not locking DOT into a intersection typical for the jog road intersection. So with that, I would like to move to recommend the new updated resolution language. Thank you.
Okay, staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And I do have quite a few.
I do have a comment on that.
I was gonna say, I do have quite a few tent cards, and I have virtual hands raised as well. I don't know if you wanna do virtual and then the in-person first.
Let's do the in-person first, and then we'll pull the virtual.
Okay.
So we'll do this before we have a motion, or should I get a motion?
It's your preference, Madam Chair.
Okay, I think we'll start. CJ?
Yes. Connor, as you know, the town of Jupiter has proposed the alternative design for the intersections. And if FDOT and after you update the information, right now the FDOT is evaluating if that is feasible.
Yes, that's correct. So we did have staff internally review it as well. They did express some concerns, particularly with the pedestrian crossings and the pedestrian islands and the number of those. But as far as the feasibility of it, I'd have to leave that to DOT. I don't know if DOT wants to speak on that. Sure. Margie, what's that?
And Madam Chair, I am Asan. I did allow you to talk, so you can unmute. That way you can provide comments.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, a little louder.
Yep. John, you can mention the comments I had, and I can try to it. if you have the list of the comments.
The geometry that we had concerns with, one was the concept that we saw was drawn with four lanes on Jog Road, as well as Atlantic Avenue at the intersection. So it doesn't provide for the six lanes for the future condition.
Yeah.
Another thing that we were looking at was regarding the shared use paths. There were no on-street bicycle lanes, so the shared use path with the 10 feet would still require 4 foot clear on both sides. So we would be expanding that by 8 feet on each side, the right-of-way widths. Hassan will talk a little bit about the analysis, but one of the other key things was the single left turn lane for the displaced lefts. If that's not feasible in order for the capacity, we would still have to put that second left, and there's also no storage to accommodate in the 8 foot median width that's shown in the typical section to allow stacking of even one single left turn lane upstream and downstream at the intersection. So we would need to look at the system in its entirety. There's still the same pedestrian and bike safety concerns as the original PDLT, and as well as the driver expectations, since the configuration is still the same. And Hassan, you want to talk a little bit about the traffic side of it?
Sure, sure. As John said, it's completely unclear how and where the system ties back into the adjacent signalized intersection. We need just to see where your crossover signal is gonna tie to the system and propose storage for each turn lane to evaluate the signal. And as John said, the AADT right now, the current AADT for Atlantic Avenue and Jog Road are over or near capacity threshold, even if the during our field visit, it's perceptible that the current traffic during rush hours cannot be accommodated using the existing geometry, which is the six lane capacity. You just reduce the capacity to four lane, and we have some concerns how it's gonna work as a without looking at the segment and network, you know, delay and travel time and level of service, except just looking at isolated intersection and say it's gonna provide acceptable level of service. To calculate the overall intersection delay, I think you use the weighted average as an approach. And based on the new manual, and we need just to include the extra distance travel time to the full displaced left turn. If you want to calculate the delay, you cannot just simply use the weighted average. I just see your numbers. The traffic volume you use for the analysis is different than the approved traffic volume we had in the PD&E, and we need just to clarify that one, how you come up with these numbers. And as you can see, this sketch, I couldn't see any crossover signals. I couldn't see any storage length. And I believe that because we have over 300 vehicles for the left turn lane, and you would need to look at the dual left turn for the eastbound left turn movements. So another thing is you're changing the cycle length to 90 to 60 seconds. We have the coordinated system for the entire things. Have you looked at the entire system or just only checked the Jog Road? Have you seen any other issues, entire corridor and network base? Because right now we have 160 second and 170 seconds as AM and PM cycle lengths, and you change to 90 to 60 seconds. Thanks.
I wish much of this conversation can occur before this meeting, because all of the technical issue has been resolved. In terms of the storage length for the left turns, in terms of the running the double cycle to be accommodated with the rest of the intersection as a system to maintain the progression opportunity. all has been worked out. And if we can convince this, the conversation much longer earlier, much earlier, I guess we can iron out the difficulty you have already raised. And I don't think it's to everybody's benefit right now here to discuss this. Let's have some conversations, some meeting later on.
Yeah, we can have a separate meeting, but as Connor said, it's still the safety concern and access concern and driver expectation is going to be remaining in addition to the right of way, if we assume that the level of service or, delay is going to be a result, you know.
And let me just briefly say to address that in terms of the pedestrian crossing, mm-hmm. as long as the bike lanes, the safety compared to the traditional intersection design, which does not allow the pedestrian to get through the intersection from corner diagonally to the other corner within a cycle. This particular design can allow the pedestrian as well as the cyclist to get through intersections, even from diagonally from one corner to the other within a cycle. And there is much less time we will be spending and crossing this intersection. So with the much less time crossing the section, that the pedestrian crossing safety will be further ensured. And the concept of design this is the pedestrian and the cyclist will be moved all through the shared use path, 12 feet to 15 feet wide, if you will, to get through intersections, as opposed to the 12 feet the crosswalk here. And the refuge island within the intersection is much, much bigger, and to have the to a staging the cyclist and pedestrian safely onto the refuge island. So I guess compared to the existing intersections, the pedestrian crossing safety is much has a full the benefit the compared to a traditional design as well. So we can discuss this in a separate meeting.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a good idea. We could probably talk offline with DOT and TPA and with you to figure that out. I think as of right now, though, the resolution doesn't necessarily preclude a design like this. It's mainly focusing on steering away from designs that have severe impacts to right-of-way and the safety of pedestrians. So I think as of right now, we could probably move that conversation offline and we can discuss a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Kevin, yeah. I think you have your card raised.
Yeah, so this motion to adopt this, it still sounds like you got a lot of details to work out. So this is just supporting the project with the details to be developed at some point in the future?
Correct. So DOT is still entering the PD&E study. So they're still going to be working through some designs of the intersection as well as the typical section. So right now we're just moving forward with supporting it. We just wanted to, honor the board's direction and steer away from designs that would severely impact right of way, typically, or specifically in the northwest section. One of the concepts with the partially displaced left had a lot of impacts to both access as well as impacts to single family homes in that northwest section. So we wanted to kind of steer away from that, but still allow DOT that flexibility to design the best typical and intersection design.
Okay, the other question I have was, it talks about a typical section with sidewalks or shared use paths of at least 10 feet in width. Is that an acceptable dimension to be considered as a shared use path?
So I believe the resolution says either a shared use path or a 10 foot wide sidewalk. I think, and I could be wrong, is that correct?
It says provide sidewalks or shared use pathways of at least 10 feet in width.
Correct. So we worded it that way because the FDM has very specific guidelines for what a shared use pathway is. For the TPA, a 10-foot wide sidewalk could be considered as a shared use pathway, but we did want to keep that wording in there so that, you know, if it's a 10-foot sidewalk to DOT, we can still build it and cyclists can utilize it as a, you know, area in which they can feel safe to bike in.
You also mentioned the other gentleman in your responses about you were going to require them to have another 8 feet of right-of-way to be able to use that 10-foot shared use pathway. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, so based on the concept that was just up, that did not have any on-street bicycle facilities. It only had the 10-foot sidewalk. It was labeled as a shared use path, but in order for it to meet shared use path criteria, it would need to be 12 feet wide and have 8 foot, or sorry, a 4 foot clear in the front and the back of that shared use path in order for it to meet that requirement. So leaving the resolution by saying 10 foot or 12, it kind of keeps that open that if we do use a 10 foot sidewalk, you can eliminate the 4 foot clear on each side, but you will still need a bicycle lane, on street bike lane with that type of concept.
Okay. I don't think the resolution says that though, does it?
It's open. It's open-ended. Or is it for the purpose of it provides sidewalks or shared use pathways of at least 10 feet in width. So it does not say anything about the removal of the on-street bike lane. So if you do go with the 10-foot sidewalk, you will need the on-street bike lane. If you go with a shared use path, it'll have to have the 4 foot clear and be 12 feet in width.
Okay, Alex?
I also need, I guess, a little bit of further clarification of how this resolution is working with the cross-sections and the alternatives that are being presented or are included, at least in the packet that we received. There were a number of slides, I guess, was similar to what we saw 2 months ago that included the original cross-section, and then there were the three alternative cross-sections. Are we still saying that all those three alternative cross sections will still be evaluated through this resolution, that we're given the green light to continue to evaluate those three cross sections that are included in this packet? Or are we, as part of this, removing one, expressing a preference for one versus another, or also allowing the inclusion of other alternatives that were not included in this packet? It's a little bit unclear how the two things work together or do not work together.
Sure. So the typical sections, I don't remember the alignments specifically. I guess we can, Margie, do you want to pull up the backup presentation? But as long as they provide a sidewalk or a shared use pathway of at least 10 feet, it wouldn't be eliminating those.
I think all three do, but I just want to make sure that's what we're actually approving through the resolution.
So the original concept had an 8 foot sidewalk on the north side. So that concept would not be applicable based on this resolution. Understood. But the new ones that we presented all fit into this criteria. So any one of those could still move forward under this resolution.
And this resolution is not indicated a preference for one versus another, because I see sometimes some on the sections at the end, the three items, I see some things that may be a little bit different from some of the whereas clauses included in the front of the resolution. So I'm just trying to make sure that we're not indicating, well, because of a whereas clause here, really what we meant was that we would like to go with this alternative versus the other. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that that's what we're doing here.
There's nothing in there. Again, we worked with DOT and the whole point of the resolution was to provide them the flexibility to develop a typical section as long as it met that criteria of meeting, you know, that sidewalk or shared use pathway.
And later in the process, is this committee going to be given the opportunity to provide an input once and the additional decisions have been made once the PD&E is advanced? Or is this it for us with regards to this road?
Good morning, I'm Rudy Gutmare. What I would like to add is in presentation that we did and the typical sections that we presented do fit this resolution, right? So as a committee, you have those three typicals that fits within this resolution, and you have an option today. You can recommend one for board's consideration. That's also a possibility, rather than come back 3 months later, 2 months later. I would rather have you take a look at those typicals again that fits with this resolution and may potentially make a recommendation that could be carried to the board. That could be one of the options.
Because there's some significant differences between some of them and the options two and some of the others. So
if we want, we can go over those three typicals that meet this language that you just saw and describe those. And maybe we can take a look at those if you want to make a recommendation today.
I just want to make sure that that would be okay. I mean, I'm okay with that. I that's not what is in the agenda.
So, as an advisory board to the board, right? We're making a recommendation from the technical side of the business. So, we've conducted an alternatives analysis, and we've developed these three typical sections. And so that's what we're going forward to. Essentially, we will finish the analysis on those three typical sections. We're still working with the water management district to try and minimize right away along the canal side of this typical section that would allow us maybe some flexibility there in the what would ultimately be recommended. We will be going to a public hearing, and this will come before the public and to those who attend. We weren't planning on coming, or we may come back before here, I don't know, before the public hearing, but
yes, before the public hearing.
To show you what we will be recommending at the public hearing. But as far as, you know, new typical sections, that's not the intent at this point. If this committee has a recommendation from a technical standpoint, you can make an amendment to the resolution. This resolution does not preclude DOT from providing bicycle lanes on street at this point. It does recommend to the board that a minimum of 10 feet be provided on both sides of the roadway. So the typical sections, these revised typical sections, which we developed, show at least 10 feet. So any one of them could still be provided as our final recommendation. If we are recommending this to the board, the presentation to them would have to be clear that you know, there's still the option of a bicycle lane on street. They're giving us that, if they were to vote this way, that leeway. And then the other bullets we haven't really talked about in terms of jog road, the only thing this would preclude is any alternative which would require relocations. So it still gives us the leeway to provide triple lefts. We can work with CJ's concept a little further, continue analysis of that. That may end up in the final recommended alternative if everything works, as long as it doesn't require relocations, either business or residential. So the way I read this is if the TAC wants to recommend a specific alternative, our team would love that. And that would be welcome guidance for the board as well from the technical. Bike Ped, as it was mentioned, we'll see this tomorrow. So they will get a recommendation as to whether or not this meets it. Bike Ped may say something else, right? And then both of those recommendations will then go before the board.
I guess for staff, what is the expectation when this item goes in front of the TPA board? Are you only asking for them to approve this resolution as is, or are you also asking them to interject or provide additional recommendations or opinions as to how FDOT should proceed beyond what is in this resolution?
So we'd be providing that resolution plus whatever the recommendations of the TAC, CAC, and BTPAC are. But that doesn't preclude the board from also providing a recommended typical section to DOT.
I would suggest that we should have that discussion since we are the technical people.
Sure. The only thing I will say is, you know, if a typical section a recommendation for a typical session isn't reached, I would still recommend moving forward with that standard resolution, just because that still allows DOT that flexibility, but also again meets the board's direction. But if the TAC would like to do make that recommendation, that's up to you again. So
okay, I have other cards. So
okay,
we've heard the comment. I'm going to move on to Brian.
Thank you. Just in looking at the typicals, you're proposing something in excess of 130-foot typical section. I mean, is that still roughly the numbers we're talking about for a right-of-way? Because I'm interested in a larger picture, or the implications of what this could mean. I mean, that's...
Correct. It's going to be up to an additional 8 feet of right-of-way from the original concept that we proposed, and we're from 4 to 8 additional feet.
And so the current ultimate right-of-way is like 120, or it's 130.
130, okay. Yeah.
It's not what we have on our typical or our thoroughfare map at the county. This is a suburban C3 context under your context manual. You all are undoubtedly doing other PD&E projects, and you're running into this throughout District 4, I'm assuming. Is this a typical example of what you're seeing in that context of you need right-of-way beyond the ultimate right-of-way that you'd previously identified? I may be asking the design people, and this is more of a planning concept, but I'm trying to understand, do we have a situation where a lot of the thoroughfare maps and so forth, ultimate right-of-way maps that have been identified, are they based on an older no vision zero, not a complete street concept? And so we're going to need to go back and modify a lot of thoroughfare maps to ultimately express larger rights of way because of these concepts of vision zero, shared use.
So
going forward, because my concern is the context may be that and to do all these other things, but we've not done the nuts and bolts, even at a county and municipal level, of what does that mean ultimately for the DOT roads? And that's what I'm trying to get at is this indicative of a larger problem we're looking at, is that the context is going to demand further changes that are going to be knock-on changes?
I think certainly. I mean, you're if this is going to be a direction that Palm Beach County is taking, so this is not something, you know, everybody's concerned about bicycles and pedestrians. Mm-hmm. How we do that is really up to each area, right?
Yeah.
That we've got different planning bodies that are kind of addressing this. The thoroughfare identification map, you know, that is the county's right-of-way reservation. Right. And clearly, I think there would be, if the typical section for this is 130 foot, at a minimum, we're mm-hmm. going to have to go back and amend the thoroughfare identification map. As you know, the county will have to do that for us to proceed. But I think you are looking at a broader policy decision countywide for all your thoroughfares, not just state roads. This would be for every county road. That's supposed to be the right-of-way that every municipality, since this is a charter county, is then planning for. So it is a much broader issue. I'll let Ms. Delaney, Dr. Delaney, weigh in on that from a regional planning council perspective, but I think I'm on target with that.
Well, just to speak to that, I'm happy to hear what Dr. Delaney has to say. We as a county have not adopted a Vision Zero. The MPO has a Vision Zero in complete streets, but the county has not, because it just hasn't been a driving issue. So all of our TEM map information is based on older concepts of, you know, 4-6 foot sidewalks on, and you could fit that in 120 to 130 feet, but these expanded pathways and so forth, you cannot. So I'm trying to figure out, you all are seeing a lot more projects on a regional basis. Are you all running into this on all of these? I'm trying to figure out, are we going to start to see this on, because Palm Beach County is largely developed under suburban context. Is that what we're running into? Because I think that's the real planning level work that this county needs to look at and the municipalities need to begin to look at.
So. This is the tip of the iceberg, right?
Right. That's what I'm trying to get to.
We we're looking at our context classes, right? We now have target speed mm-hmm. built into the FDM. And so we've had to do some retrofitting of looking at all our target speeds for every project that's in development right now. Okay. And this project not having reached its final public hearing is probably the first PD&E study ongoing that we've had to maybe make this adjustment and have this discussion about. I do think that we don't have a lot of roadway widening projects in Palm Beach County. Most of it are 6 lanes. We're not going to 8 lanes. So I think in some regards, we'll be retrofitting, right? Looking at some of the corridors as we come in for 3R resurfacing projects. Mm-hmm. How can we make better accommodations? We won't be buying right-of-way typically on a 3R project, certainly not corridor-wide, maybe in certain instances at intersections to make better accommodations. There's a higher focus on safety. So from a safety perspective, there may be opportunities to go back and look at projects. If that becomes the priority of the county and the TPA, then that will be what the department endeavors to do along its state roads. But yes, you know, this is for us, this is the tip of the iceberg.
Thank you, Natalie. Kim?
So, I mean, to John's point, right? We're at paradigm shift stage with respect to how we plan roadways. I mean, that's what the Regional Planning Council sees. So in every municipality we work with, this same conversation is coming up, which is we have roadways that move cars very quickly at the expense of everything else. And so, you know, to John's point, it really is tip of the iceberg, because it's not just the state roadway network where every single resurfacing project is the same conversation, right? Think about Lake Worth Road, where we took extraordinary effort to find a way to get the sidewalk from, I think we got it from 6 to 8 feet in a condition where we have people getting hit and killed, you know, on a regular basis, bicyclists and pedestrians. So the larger question beyond the FDOT state roadway network is the county roadway network. And that's a lot trickier, right? And this board has had lots of conversations about Vision Zero and complete streets and context appropriate and context sensitive design. And we have been working with communities in partnership with the TPA, like Indian Trail Improvement District, where an 80-foot five lane typical section means you have really 5 and 6 foot bike lanes, no landscaping and no buffers. And so there's a larger conversation to be had in Palm Beach County if this is the direction we're going to go in, which is the rights of way that we have can't accommodate all of the needs on those facilities to make them complete. They only solve one part of the equation, which is moving cars quickly. But they don't solve the other part of the equation, which is accommodating the other users in the network. So I just thought I would throw that out there. This is a very interesting conversation. And I think it's remarkable that DOT, as a partner agency, is listening as closely as it is to the concerns that are raised by the TPA and the municipalities, reading the same headlines that we're all reading, and trying to find ways for a more complete roadway network. It's going to be more expensive. We don't have enough land to accommodate all that we need. So that's just part of the, you know, evaluation as we move forward. So that would be our observation. And we've only worked with, I don't know, 20 municipalities in Palm Beach County, let's say, in the last 10 years or so. And this same conversation, this is the consistent conversation. We don't have enough right-of-way to accommodate what we need. So, you know, credit to DOT for trying to find a way to accommodate the needs in this particular example. And as a policy position for the TPA board to say, you know, not good enough. We need 10-foot minimum off-road facilities to accommodate cyclists. Don't expand your road otherwise. That's a really loud, bold, progressive statement that responds directly to those concerns that we all see. So.
Thank you. Natalie?
Thank you. I just have a couple questions because I'm trying to understand where we are in the process. It related to Alex's comments on, you know, whether this committee should evaluate at this current moment the alternatives that are suggested. So from what I understand, DOT has presented a previous project as part of the TIP, and it was not supported by the TPA governing board. And since that time, TPA staff has been working with DOT to refine alternatives to accommodate the needs of all users. And so these suggested alternatives are being conceptually approved, and you've crafted a resolution which captures these concepts, but DOT is still going, has to go through the entire PD&E process, right?
So the presentation that the board received was somewhat similar to this. It had different typical sections. It had different alignments for the jog road intersection. The board just expressed concerns about certain aspects of some of the concepts. And that's where we started working with DOT directly to kind of figure out which typicals we could move forward with, which typicals we didn't want to move forward with based off those discussions that the board had. And that's kind of where this resolution comes in, where it kind of, it phrases it so that it gets rid of those concepts like that displaced left that was eliminating, I think it was 8 homes or something like that. It gets rid of those, but still maintains certain typicals and intersection alignments. But again, it still allows DOT to have that flexibility to continue with their PD&E process, have their public meetings, show the public different options and see what they think of those different typical sections. So.
Right. So the PD&E process is still all yet to occur, which includes public workshops and community input. Where are we in this process? What I'm trying to get to is, are we going to be actually, is this committee going to have an opportunity in the future where once a true alternative is selected, we have a chance to be able to review that?
Okay. John, may I?
Yeah.
Okay. Just to give a little bit of a time frame, we did have a public workshop four months ago. That public workshop was based on a typical section that was used for alternatives analysis that was concurred by TPA at that time. And we went for the public meeting, but from that public workshop, and since the typical section was approved by TPA, approved may not be the correct word, concurred by TPA, the board decided to change the philosophy about how the pedestrians and bicycle movement should be handled. So after our public workshop, during the public meeting, there were some comments made about potentially separating bicycle lane from adjacent to the travel lane. So we went back to the board after that, our public workshop, to present a summary of public workshop and what alternatives were presented at the public workshop. And during that board meeting, we were requested by the board to look at potentially separating the bicycle lane from the travel lane and maybe using shared use pathway that meets the FDM guidelines. So since then, we went back to the drawing board. We worked with the TPA hand in hand. We developed 4 or 5 other typical sections that meets the FDM, Florida Design Manual, for the design. And we presented that to TPA. And in that meeting, TPA staff and TPA staff looked at those typicals. And based on that, there were 3 typical sections that kind of met the board's guidelines to see what we can do, either to separate bicyclists from the travel lane. And what typical sections that you see here that was presented during the previous presentation, there were 3-4 typicals that kind of met those guidelines that the direction board provided to us. And we presented those typical sections during our last meeting. And at that meeting, I think there was some language discussion that happened on the resolution that needed to be done. So answer to your question, we have already spent 18 months developing the alternatives, meeting with the board, conducting the public workshop. Now here with the guidance or the direction for the board, we are evaluating 1 or 2 more typical sections that something that board wants to look at on a Palm Beach County roadways. And we did that all that work, and now we are presenting that so we can move forward to implementing one of those typical sections and then get ready for the public hearing. So we have already 18 months, 19 months in the project. We were planning to hold a public hearing in December, but since board's new guidance, the direction, we are already late 4 or 5 months in that process. So that's the storyline.
And when you say Palm Beach County roadways, the alternative sections are limited to this project that you are presenting, correct? Even though I understand from a philosophy perspective, it is the tip of the iceberg and we are changing, and having this conversation is healthy. And the fact that we're even considering this and talking about this, I think that's healthy, but I'm just trying to understand the scope of our action today. So we know what to do, because it seems that TPA staff has been working cooperatively and has agreed upon language that meets everybody's needs. And at this point in time, I just feel like, you know, we'd be undermining the PD process if this committee is, you know, picking a favorite at this point in time. I personally would rather see an alternative selected as part of the PD&E and then be presented with it. That's my personal opinion.
Kim?
Kim, can I have you turn your mic on for me?
There we go. I just use a playground voice and I can get like all the way across. So to Natalie's point, there's two issues that we're discussing. One is this kind of global approach to more complete streets across the county and the various ways that has to happen over time. And the other is, what are we going to do with this project? It seems as though the TPA staff has done a great job in identifying those boundaries. I'm going to say move to approve the resolution proposed by TPA staff, and appreciate the department's willingness to work as hard as it is. So, motion. Second.
And Madam Chair, I do, so I have a motion by Kim and a second by Natalie, but I do have Mo with his hand that's raised as well.
Okay, Mo.
Thank you. Interesting discussions. My question to FDOT and to the consultant, I remember first time when they came to present this project, they did their evaluation. I think I'm muted, right? You can hear me, right? I have a note here saying that. Okay. All right. So, they came and presented that displaced or partially displaced left turns alternative for the intersection with Jog Road. And they selected that one as the best alternative. And they were all enthusiastic about it. And they were expecting and hoping that we were going to be endorsing it and approving it. Now I see them having a kind of a pushback on what CJ has done. And I want to thank CJ for all the work that he has done on this concept. And I know that he has a stake on that because he is concerned with another similar intersection in his jurisdiction that needs improvements as well. I hear throughout, you know, when that is discussed, driver expectations. I hate to hear that all the time when we are trying to introduce new concepts, and actually FDOT has done that with the introduction of the DDI, and people, that defines the driver's expectations, and it has been working really well, and there are several implementations within the state, and we have plans to implement so many of them now by DOT along I-95. And also, they have bigger one for the intersection of Beeline Highway and North Lake, which implements also concepts that are kind of a little different. So that driver expectation should not be something that we bring up as an excuse to push back on any otherwise good alternative. And then the other thing that was brought up, the pedestrian safety, et cetera, and I think CJ has addressed that really well. And my point all the time is with the new concept that with the displaced left turn design concept, actually, I believe the pedestrian safety is extremely enhanced because you can provide, especially the concern was about the free flow rights, you can provide a signalization for pedestrians to cross those lanes, et cetera, and there are some refuge islands that are created in the process. The other thing is right-of-way and the impact of right-of-way. It seems like some of the concepts that are being proposed here would have more impact on the right-of-way than what was proposed initially. I'm glad that the resolution as proposed would not eliminate this concept in totality, and it will allow still room for FDOT, and I hope they will sincerely indulge into evaluating that concept and looking at it meticulously to make a final good determination that is based on facts. Not, you know, just slogans and perceptions and et cetera, about how well that will serve the needs of the community. That leads me to a question to FDOT. So if we go ahead with this endorsement of this resolution. What would be, and I understand that leaves the floor open for FDOT to select one of several alternatives, because we are not restricting them that far. So what would be the criteria that they would use when they finally select the alternative that they want to go ahead with? That one question. And the other question is, what is at this point, what is FDOT's and their consultants' recommendation on the alternative that they think is the best fit given all the considerations? So two questions. What would be the criteria for FDOT if we adopt this resolution, they move on to for them to select the final alternative? And secondly, what is their recommended alternative from the alternatives that are in front of us now?
The answer to the first part of the question, once there's a resolution on the language, we already have done a lot of work on evaluating all these typical sections and done some conceptual analysis about impacts. So once a typical section is recommended, then we will have to work with the Lakewood Drainage District, which is one of the big stakeholder also on this project, because we will have to buy some right-of-way from their canal widths. So that will be the next step. Once this typical section is decided, then we'll go through design of the alternative with this typical, look at environmental impact, look at physical impacts, look at right-of-way impacts, and then develop an evaluation matrix with all these factors, and then look at the cost. And kind of once that's done, a decision or discussion will happen. And then, of course, public input is always a key factor on any of this PDNE study, local stakeholders, including you all. So we will put all that stuff together and then make an appropriate decision on which would be the recommended option. Once we DOT department working with all the stakeholders comes up with the recommended alternatives, then that will be presented at the public hearing. So all the stakeholders get another opportunity to look at the recommended alternative, get more comments on those alternatives, and then move back and move forward with the location design concept approval from the OEM office. So these are the steps we're going to go through to get that LDC approved for one recommended alternative. What was the second question, Mo?
What is your favorite or recommended alternative from the ones that you presented now? Typically, you know, when a study is done, you know, an evaluation is done, you come back and say what are the pros and cons of each, and you make recommendation. So what would be your recommended alternative based on your evaluation?
Well, right now, I don't have a recommended alternative. When we went to the public workshop, that was in June, last week of June, we had presented a couple of horizontal alignment alternatives, three intersection alternatives based on the typical section that was already concurred by the TPA. But now that we are looking at the new typical section, so the right-of-way impacts are going to change. Some of the costs are going to change. So based on the typical that gets recommended now, we'll go through that evaluation again and then come up with that evaluation matrix, compare with two, three other typicals and alignments alternatives we looked at, and then develop that evaluation matrix again. We have already gone through that exercise in June to present it to the public. So we had to go through that process and it's, you know, and then come up with the alternative that could be the recommended for public hearing. And at that point, again, everybody will get an opportunity to make comments on those. But that would be our, whatever alternative that comes out of that evaluation matrix would be a recommended alternative for the department.
Sorry, Madam Chair, if I may, I'm sorry for, I apologize to everybody for taking so much time because I know that we are already into late morning with this, and this is the second item on the agenda, or the first. So that's just one question. So I understand now that we have all agreed that the consultant and FDOT will be going back and discussing with a select group of technical people, the technical aspects of the evaluation of the alternative with the displaced left turns concept and make some conditions as a result of that. Is that correct? John probably can answer that question.
So Mo, from an operational standpoint, this nothing has changed with these typical sections. So this board has looked at the operations and essentially we're providing a 6-lane roadway. The big alternatives came into play at Jog Road. And then the revised typical sections specifically relate to how much right of way is going to be acquired and how we're going to take this piece of Atlantic Avenue, right, from Turnpike to Jog and retrofit it or transition it from the piece to the east. And we've got a project already under design to the west. So it is a balancing act. More right of way we need, more money we need. It'll take longer to then acquire the monies in the work program and fully fund the right of way. So the what the effect of the decision of this TPA will have on the project, we will listen to the direction given by the board in terms of their desires. And if we can make it fit within our FDM guidelines, we will go forward with that as our recommended alternative, secure our environmental approval, and then start amassing the monies necessary to do this. So one of the things that we've been told is this is a very high priority for the TPA. By the public, it can't happen fast enough. So those are two things that we've got design already underway for this, I think this consultant's been selected for this. So we're ready to go to the next phase, but we do need direction on what the typical section needs to be. And I know we're wrestling with much bigger programmatic issues. To some degree, I would say, let's put some of that aside and think about this from engineering and planning perspective of a 1-mile segment of roadway along an entire corridor where we're essentially taking a 6-lane section, widening it to the west, and trying to consider all the directions that the board has given us, that Vision Zero and Target Zero is giving us, you know, and make the best economic decision that will provide relief, because this is a congestion-driven project. This project wasn't going to 6 lanes to solve the fatality issue. It's really a congestion problem. There's traffic need out there today. So purpose and need is driven by how can we get 6 lanes out there and now do so in the most responsible fashion from an economic and safety perspective. And so if this board can give us direction on where they want to, you know, do they want to offset production timeline to accommodate wider typical section for specific purposes, that's the direction we're looking for. And I believe that the resolution gives us the latitude to include a bike lane on the roadway if we need to, as long as we provide up to 10-foot sidewalks. And then if the board goes ahead and if the TAC approves that, recommends that, and the board approves it, then we will finish our analysis saying probably, you know, I can't preclude what we're going to say, but I would recommend or suggest that I could see or envision 10-foot sidewalks without 4-foot buffers, because that's another 8-foot of right-of-way. It would have no guardrail along the north side of the roadway, because that would be very difficult to retrofit with all the driveways. And I know one of the commissioners wanted to see, you know, guardrail separated bicycle lanes. And then we would have, I can't tell, maybe Rudy can tell me whether we'd have 5 or 7-foot buffered bicycle lanes, but probably 7-foot buffered bicycle lanes, because that meets the FDM. And then we would have a cost, but we can't go to the water management district and start negotiating for reduced right-of-way widths in their canal. And they're not going to do that for 3 alternatives. They're only going to do that with 1 alternative. They've told us that. So we need to go to them with our recommended alternative, and then we can start those negotiations to minimize the right-of-way. In the meantime, what happens at Jog Road, as long as we're told don't take any relocations, now we can maximize, we can look at CJ's alternative, do some more analysis. We will do that. We're not going to just make an emotional decision on, yeah, this doesn't look good. We're at this point and we don't want to go back and look at it. We'll look at that, take a hard look, from an operational perspective, if that provides us as good or better operations, doesn't take any residences or businesses, I don't see why that wouldn't be part of our recommended alternative.
Thank you, John. And I emphasize again that, you know, a thorough examination and evaluation of the concept at Jog Road needs to be done. And I cannot emphasize again more the need for simulation and modeling, appropriate modeling for the entire corridor, including that intersection and the vicinity of that intersection as part of the entire corridor to see that whether that will work or not and how well it will work. And I truly appreciate you taking this position. And I again appreciate the work done by CJ. We here at Palm Beach County, our staff looked into all the material that CJ provided to us. We feel that it should work, and we support the conclusions that came with CJ, but we are looking for an affirmation for all of that based on modeling, because again, of the queuing and the spacing of the key junctures for this whole thing to work. So thank you.
Thank you, Mo. Thank you, John. Alex?
So in the documents that we provided and in the packet for this meeting, I saw that there was an alternatives comparison that was included. I assume from looking at the different columns here that those alternatives are the ones that we're looking at, are the cross sections that we're looking at. There was a reference to the 7-foot buffer bike lane, which was the original one that was submitted. And then I see three others, which I assume are section one, alternative section 1, 2, and 3.
Correct.
So you have done some type of analysis comparing or evaluating those three alternatives. So I'm a little bit, you indicated that you needed to evaluate and compare them. And so that has happened to a great extent.
May I?
Sure.
So the conceptual, that evaluation that you see is conceptual, right? We took the typical section, for example, the typical section 1. We need with the 2 shared use pathways on both sides, the typical that are for discussions is typical number 1 that we see here on the screen, which has 2 shared use pathways on both sides, no bike lanes adjacent to the travel lane. Typical number 2, we have a physically separated bike lanes, and then we have 10-foot sidewalks on both sides of the roadway. And the third typical is, again, no bike lanes and guardrail and multi-use pathway on the both sides. So what we did, we took these widths, 138 foot, 130 foot, or 132 feet, and then conceptually looked at what would, in a higher level, what would be the right-of-way impacts, how much extra right-of-way we going to need, what impact is going to have on a pedestrian and bicyclist. Now, once we select one, and that's at a conceptual level, once we select whichever the typical section gets recommended, then we will actually have to do alignment, like engineering drawing to be more concise with the impacts. You know, in some locations, it could be more, modify the intersections, modify the intersection geometry and all that. So there's a difference between, so that's why I said we did a conceptual level analysis. And once that's done, once the typical is selected, we'll do a detailed analysis like we did before our alternatives workshop to present it to everyone.
And I took a somewhat deeper look at this table, and I do have some questions as to, because you ranked them basically, right? From worst to best, you had 4 categories, color base. I just had a few, and I don't know whether that's something that should happen afterwards, whether you have that's a discussion that we need to have now. But I did have a few questions as to how some of those were arrived at. So one question is from a right-of-way impact. And again, the shared use paths is alternative 1, physically separated bike lanes is alternative 2, and shared use paths with sheet pile walls is alternative 3, correct? That's what they correspond to here. Right-of-way impacts, you indicate that alternative 3, the one further to the right, is the one with the least right-of-way impact. I'm trying to understand, based on the cross-sections that we saw, alternative 2 needed 134 feet of right-of-way. Alternatives 1 and 3 needed 138 feet of right-of-way. So I'm trying to understand how one option that requires more right-of-way than another would have a lesser right-of-way impact according to this table. Okay.
So right-of-way impacts can be defined in a couple of ways, right? To the adjacent properties. I'm going to go back for a second. See, here, when I mentioned about conceptual, what you see those lines that we have drawn for the different alternatives, these are conceptual right-of-way impacts we looked at it. And when you put the sheet pile wall, right, that will be within the Lakewood Drainage District right-of-way. So right-of-way for the project that's impacts private residences and the communities, and right-of-way impacts to the Lakewood Drainage District for their canal right-of-way. So when you compare all those, that's what you see there, the green, the yellows, and the reds. I mean, we can go through a lot of discussions on that if you would like, but that will take a lot of time to go through it.
And that's fine. My other bigger question with regards to this one, and again, that is the big issue that I have with the alternatives that are being proposed. From a bicycle pedestrian safety, we're saying that all three options, all three alternatives are the same or similar, all have a green dot. According to this alternatives comparison. As I indicated in the meeting that we had 2 months ago, I had a significant concern with any option that removes on-street bicycle lanes. There is a safety concern because you're still going to have two things, cyclists still using the road, but now there's absolutely no place for them to go in there. So, to indicate that an option that includes that would have the same level of bicycle pedestrian safety than an option that actually provides on-street bicycle lanes. I have a disagreement there. The second one is if we're now saying, well, all of those cyclists are now going to be using this shared use path. Several studies have shown that shared use paths in areas where there's a number of conflict points between the cyclist and vehicles can actually result in an increase in accidents. A few weeks ago, I was in this general area. I decided to drive to this corridor because I hadn't been there in a while. I just wanted to familiarize myself with the corridor. And there's some diversity in the corridor. And not all areas are the same, but some sections there have a multitude of curb cuts, driveways, there's commercial plazas with supermarkets, cinemas, and things like that. If we're now saying all those cyclists are going to be using this shared use path right there, some of them riding on the opposite way, so drivers coming in and out of the driveways may not even pay attention to them. I think that actually it is a safety danger. And so I have a concern with this matrix indicating that if an alternative that provides both on-street facilities as well as off-street facilities would have exactly the same safety level as facilities or as alternatives that do not provide any on-road bicycle facilities. So I do have a question as to why we're saying all three alternatives provide the same level of bicycle pedestrian safety. To me, that is not accurate because facilities without bicycle lanes do not provide the same level of bicycle safety than facilities with bicycle lanes.
Your point well noted. If you look at the Florida design manual, all options, whether it's a multi-use pathway or combination of bicycle lane adjacent to travel lane and a sidewalk, they're all allowed. And I think that's the biggest change in the context design.
Allowed and the level of safety that they provide, which is what we're ranking here.
Yeah, and to answer your question, that's why when we looked at the typical sections, when we were asked to look into that a little bit more, the typical sections that TPA also concurred with three different typicals. One that you see here, where the bike lanes are removed from adjacent travel lane. A typical section that does provide a little bit of a separation between vehicles, which is we are discussing that as a physically separated bike lane that meets what you are talking about. Or the third option is multi-use pathway with the sheet pile option to minimize the right of way on the Lakewood Drainage District. So we do have choices. And now whatever, as a TAC committee, you want to endorse one typical versus others. And that's what we are looking for the guidance. I mean, we provided everything that's possible within the Florida Design Manual guidelines based on TPA board's recommendations, based on your comments. And these are the options that are here.
The criteria that was used to indicate that okay. All three alternatives provide the same level of bicycle pedestrian safety from at least from a bicycle standpoint. Mm-hmm. We can
certainly respect, yeah. I everything that you mentioned is valid, right? You're a professional in the business. And I think in terms of the body of knowledge that's accepted by Florida DOT and the Florida Design Manual, we don't have a design in there that we believe is unsafe or one is less safe than the other. So we are accommodating the pedestrians and bicyclists in a safe fashion. Now, degrees of safety, there's a couple studies that are suggesting.
This indicates, I thought that the colors indicated degrees of safety, but.
Well, and so this was our assessment. Mm-hmm. And if you have a contrary point of view, this is a great forum to bring it up. And, you know, if you think we should change those, we can certainly, that should be a recommendation, you know, to the board. But.
Yeah. Well, one thing that you did point out, you said you do not support.
Sorry, can you talk into the microphone? Thank you.
One thing you pointed out was that you do not support an alternative that does not provide the on-street bike lane, and
I do not again because okay. of the concerns that I just indicated. I think it increases risk for cyclists. There's going to be cyclists riding on this road, and now they have absolutely won't have a facility. And second, again, if we're now saying all of them should be riding on this other facility, that'll be okay if we had an area in which there's no conflicts with vehicles. There's multiple conflict points. And again, that's why I wanted to drive the area. I'm familiar, mm-hmm. There's quite a few. So that would create a less than safe situation for cyclists.
I respect your comments, and those are very valid comments, but still we have to go forward with one alternative that you all recommend. So. That's what the guidance we are looking for. Okay. To move forward this project, we are already 6-7 months delayed. So help us to move forward and make this project, which is a priority for the county and the TPA, to the PDNE and final design and ultimately construction. So okay. That's what we are looking for.
I have another comment, Levi.
Yes, thank you. How do you envision Palm Tram boarding and alighting passengers with the guardrail? We don't currently have service on Atlantic Avenue, but it is part of the 561 corridors, and we envision that in the future. So I'm curious how the mechanics of that would work.
At those, when we looked at this typical, I don't think we identified, I mean, maybe unless something is new is added, we did not see any existing or proposed travel routes along the corridor. Now in future, if you decide to do that, there could be like pockets could be implemented for the buses to pull if you need to pull out. Or I think there are several locations throughout South Florida where we have bus stops with the guardrail. And that's why having those could probably provide some openings. And those are the treatments detail that could be sorted out in design eventually if bus stops are proposed along this corridor in future.
Yeah, right now, even in today's condition, although there are no stops there, there is a section midway, I think a little bit near Hagen Ranch, where that type of opening has already been put in place where the guardrail is. So as he mentioned, we would be able to accommodate by putting in those pockets if need be in the future for putting in those stops.
Okay, thank you.
CJ.
Yes. Let me go back to the issue raised by Alex. I do share your concern, okay? Because the speed differential allowing both motor users run on the and the walk on the shared use path does create the safety concern, especially when the level service was
degraded or the volume of the pedestrian flow increases. In some of the jurisdictions, I have a visit like Cambridge in the city of Boston. They actually do not allow the biker to run on the sidewalk. So what would be the compromise then? Can FDOT consider the option that dividing that the 12-foot shared use path into by striping into left side is bike lane or right side, but only for the pedestrian flow? I mean, it's not the panacea, but at least this is option for the running boss of this, I mean, the in their own separate right of way.
That may take care of any issues of speed differentials between pedestrians and cyclists, but I don't think that would address the issue of the conflict points between cyclists and cars at drive-throughs and other areas, because you're still going to have the cyclists using the same facility. And again, drivers, the problem is drivers are not even expecting cyclists, which are going much faster than pedestrians, to be coming back and forth in both directions in this type of facility. That is why this type of situation in context with a lot of conflicts can be quite dangerous, because the drivers are not expecting to see bicycles moving in both directions quite quickly.
You mean
right there on, let's say, on the sidewalk or chair use path, which in this case is pretty much the same.
You mean on driveway?
As they are pulling in and out, as they are making turning movements, as the drivers are making turning movements in and out of the road, in those driveways, in those intersections, in those access points, they are not paying attention. They're not thinking, well, there may be cyclists coming in both directions. There's going to be very quickly, so they do not, they may think there may be pedestrians, but again, pedestrians move significantly slower. So the chances of a driver pulling and then hitting a pedestrian at those points is less, not existent, is less than having that conflict with a cyclist. Again, this works if you have minimal conflicts. If you have significant conflicts, which there are in quite a few portions of this corridor, that is what I see as the main concern with forcing all cyclists into this type of facility.
Yeah, I can see the both having the on-street biking facility as well as in conjunction with the 10-foot sidewalk has the least amount of the right-of-way requirement.
It is my preferred one. And again, I'm not sure we're in a motion. That would be the one that I would support out. Section 2, which provides those two types of facilities. There's still a 10-foot share facility for pedestrians or cyclists who may not want to be riding on the road, as well as an on-road facility, and also has less right-of-way required, 130 feet, 34 feet as opposed to 138. I think would be the one that would be the best option in this case. That would be the one that I would suggest we recommend if we are going that route.
Okay, thank you. Maria.
Yes, I would like to go back to the item that we have in front of us. The resolution that we are evaluating, it has like three conditions. First one is provide sidewalks or shared use path of at least 10 feet in width. Is this supposed to be at both sides of the road?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, should we then spell it out? I just feel more comfortable if it is spelled out.
That's up to the TAC. I have no reservations. Okay. About that.
I would amend my motion to include that, because that's been a point of conflict in other projects.
Okay,
I will second that motion.
Natalie is the second.
That's fine.
Okay.
The next one is, if feasible, without moving the construction start date or purchasing additional right of way, extend these facilities. I'm assuming these facilities pertain to the sidewalks or shared use pathways.
Yes.
We may want to spell it out. I'm not sure. Doesn't really matter.
We didn't spell it out just because, I mean, we could probably clarify it a little bit more, but we didn't spell it out in there just because the first clause is a little bit open, again, to allow for DOT that flexibility. But if you have a recommendation to help clarify that sentence.
You're clarifying it for the record.
Okay.
I feel. Okay.
For further clarification, just a question. So by these facilities, if the option is to go with on-street bike lanes and off-road facilities, then these facilities would include both things, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, it would be clear.
Again, if feasible and if it, you know, fits in with those parameters, then yes, correct.
Okay. Maria?
Okay, if that is the case, maybe we want to add in here that instead of extend these facilities, maybe extend pedestrian and bicycle facilities. That way is 100% clear.
So the other projects, and I guess, John, correct me if I'm wrong, they do include bike ped facilities on those projects. The idea here is to make them consistent, if again, feasible. So it would be to whatever concept is decided here, to extend those to those other projects that are already going on. Again, one's already in design and the other one is, I guess, going through, is it feasibility? I'm not sure, but they're already in the process. So again, I do wanna highlight that if feasible, we'd be extending those. But again, making it consistent if possible.
Okay, so if we were to spell it out, it will be confusing. Because to me, it's more clear if you tell me exactly what these facilities means. We mean that if you do this for pedestrians here, we want you to continue this way. And if you do it for bikers here, we're going to continue this way. And that's why I thought it would be, clear.
I think that they're allowing for alternatives, and then whatever alternative they choose will be extended.
Correct.
Yeah. That's how the language reads. So...
Okay, and then the next one is a lot more difficult because it's gonna eliminate components of the build alternative with significant adverse impacts. Who defines what a significant adverse impact is? And that's, I don't know who makes that. I mean, who makes the cut? Is this significant adverse or is not? And I'm just wondering what the meaning is.
Sure. So, I mean, this one, it sort of directly refers to that, again, that partially displaced left turn where it was having large impacts to homes and businesses. And that's kind of where this clause C here is getting at. We don't want to, and the board's direction is, again, to not include build alternatives that are seeing homes removed, seeing access to businesses cut out. So that's what that clause is referring to. And that's what the significant portion is, again, referring to.
Okay. Thank you, Maria. Okay, I have a motion by Kim and a second by Natalie to support the resolution as with the modification. All in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
So I have none opposed and I have it. It's passing unanimously, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to three informational items, PalmTran Major Transit Development Plan, TDP update. I'd like to invite PalmTran staff and consultants to present this item.
Good morning. So we're excited to share our 10-year strategic vision today called the Transit Development Plan. Joe Quigley from Tyndall Oliver is going to be presenting our plan and showing all of the efforts that we've put in over the last several months to make this a reality. Joe?
Thank you, Levi. Good morning, everybody. I'm just today briefly going to go over the TDP background and process, summarize the public outreach that we did, talk about the 10-year needs that were identified and evaluated, and review the 10-year financial and implementation plans and next steps. Okay. So for those of you who don't know, TDP Transit Development Plan is a 10-year strategic plan for transit. We look at the existing conditions, determine future needs, come up with alternatives, evaluate those alternatives, and provide a list of projects for the next 10 years. And TDPs have major updates every 5 years, but the agency also does annual updates for each year in between. A TDP is a requirement by DOT for the transit agency to receive their grant block funding. And I think it's important to note that although you're going to see projects with cost tied to them, the TDP is not a budget. It's not a binding agreement. Changes can be made in any of the annual updates or as the situation warrants. So the TDP, it's a guidance document for the transit agency. It's not just for planning, it's for development, operations, and maintenance. And as I mentioned, we identify needs, define solutions, and then set the vision for the next 10 years. Our public outreach, we ended up having to do virtual outreach because unfortunately at the time that we started this project, the Delta variant was pretty rampant. So with the exception of a couple operator surveys, all of our outreach was done virtually. And this includes our stakeholder committee, which included representatives from County Engineering, DOT, the Palm Trans Service Board, the TPA, and the Career Source of Palm Beach County. They really helped us through this process, guided the process, and reviewed the documents. So through our virtual outreach, though, we were very happy. We were able to engage over 12,000 people in the process through interviews, workshops, surveys, discussion groups, and social media. So I'm just going to quickly go over some of the results of our online survey. You see we have over 750 responses to this. Over 85% of the people who responded had used Palm Trans services previously, and 40% of them said they used it on a frequent or, daily basis. And we specifically asked this question prior to March 2020 so that people were giving us the response before COVID impacted transit services. We also asked them the top three reasons why they used Palm Tran, and you can see the highest 62% were because they do not have a car. The second most common reason was to save money, and then 9% felt that the bus was just a safer way to travel. The top three reasons people gave us for not using Palm Tran were that it takes longer than driving, there are no bus stops near them so that they can access the service, or that it's too difficult for them to get to the bus stop near them. And so, thank you. I failed to mention, we structured our outreach around three questions, which is where are we now, where are we going, and how do we get there? And so if you look now at where are we going, we had more than 2/3 of respondents agree that transit was going to be really important in the future for Palm Beach County, both because of increasing congestion as well as the aging population. We asked them three things that Palm Tran could do to improve ridership. And they responded more frequent service, more regional express or commuter service, and more weekend service. And then we, in the survey, asked them, so how do we get there? Because I'm sure, as all of you know, funding is always an issue. And for transit, it's really the operating side of the house, not as much as capital. So we didn't get specific. We just asked them if they would support a dedicated local funding source for transit. And you can see 64% of them said that they would be likely to support it. 67% said that they would need more information, or more information would help them to support it. So one of the key components of the TDP is a situation appraisal. And this basically takes all the information and data that we collected through that existing conditions analysis, and looks at what are the implications of that analysis for transit. And so you can see here in this graphic, all the components of the situation appraisal that we look at in the colored circle, socioeconomic trends, travel trends, land use, et cetera. And you can see the text boxes on the outside are what we found are the implications for transit. And in multiple cases, improving the frequency of the core network is one of the recommendations. There was also a recommendation based on where we are with the pandemic of really focusing on trying to rebuild ridership post-COVID. So the next two slides are going to show the 10-year needs that were identified. And I would point out that these were identified by Palm Trans staff through ongoing efforts, and the TDP really just organized them And then when we get to the plan, put them in a phased schedule. And so some of the examples ongoing, the regional express service from Port St. Lucie to West Palm Beach has been something that's been going on for a while. Obviously the 561 plan adopted by the TPA is something that was already identified. But you can also see that we've made some recommendations based on some of the public feedback we got, which is improving the west to east connectivity on Route 40 by increasing the frequency of that service. So then these needs are capital needs, policy needs, plans and studies, and technology needs. There's just a couple of things that I wanted to point out here. So PalmTran was already working on a park and ride facility study. And what the recommendation in the TDP is that as that study is finalized and recommendations come out of that, those need to be put into the TDP moving forward. And then I also wanted to point out the Wi-Fi enabled fleet. All of PalmTran's fixed route buses currently have Wi-Fi. So this is looking at Wi-Fi on the connection buses as well as the Go Glades service. So this slide tries to condense our evaluation process where we identified the needs. We took them through an evaluation process that basically had four criteria: public support, ridership potential, connectivity, and financial feasibility. And through that process, we came up with a priority ranking of improvements, which you see on the right side of the slide. Sunday service, span improvements, regional express service. Again, you can see how that ties back to the comments that we got through the outreach, the survey, as well as some of the stakeholder interviews. So I apologize because I know that you're not going to be able to read this slide in detail, but this is a summary of the 10-year plan service improvements. Again, these are tied. You can see we have estimated operating costs as well as capital costs. And again, just to highlight a few things, you can see in that the top portion of the table, most of that is the core network improvements, improving the frequencies on those corridors that are PalmTran's core network that also overlap with the 561 plan. And then this is the summary of those other areas. So for plans, capital infrastructure, and technology improvements. And so one of the things I wanted to point out here for the TAC is that in the technology section, you can see there are a number of transit signal priority projects that are included in the TDP. So the next two slides here give you a financial summary of the plan. This first slide focuses on the operating expenses. And so the light blue bars show the total operating expenses, which for the 10 years of the plan are $1.4 billion. The orange bars show the current or anticipated revenue, which is at $1.32 billion. So you can see the purple shows you where there's a shortfall, which is totals $127 million for the 10-year plan. Now, one of the studies that's in the TDP is the next major update in fiscal year 26. So the hope is that by the time we get to that TDP, we will have identified other funding sources and this shortfall will shrink. So this is a very similar graph that looks at the capital expenses. And again, you can see we have $209 million in capital costs for the 10 years, $190 million in revenue, and a shortfall of about $19 million. It's a much smaller shortfall than there is on the operating side. And so then for next steps, we're going to the Board of County Commissioners for approval of TDP, and then the TDP will be submitted to FDOT by the end of December. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, Alex.
I was just curious with the recently signed infrastructure bill, signed a couple of weeks ago, that included hundreds of billions for transit. That was not for both capital and operational funding of transit. I mean, levels never seen before. Do you guys
if you can just speak to the microphone, please? We can hardly hear you.
Wow, never heard
Thank
that
you.
Before in my life. But
It's true. sorry. So do you know if there's going to be any new funding sources that would be available to PamTran that would address some of these funding deficiencies that you have identified here? And if there are, and again, I understand that the trickling down of some of that may take some time and some of the details may have to be worked out. But again, would that maybe result in those deficiencies, funding deficiencies being addressed, and maybe make some revisions before 2026 to the TDP to reflect any new funding that could become available as a result of this bill?
So I don't know the specific answer to your question in terms of, I don't know if we included the infrastructure bill in this. I know we included the American Rescue Plan. That's considered the funding that's coming from that. But Levi, I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I can chime in on that. So we did not include the new infrastructure bill into this plan. We didn't have those details at the time when we were actually developing the plan, but a lot of the details haven't been worked out yet either. So we don't know the level of funding that we're going to receive at a local level. We do know what we're receiving from the ARP funds, the American Rescue Plan Act funds, and those were included. But the rest is to be determined. I think it's a great question, and it could help us with any potential shortfalls, though there are other mechanisms for us to be able to do that as well.
Quickly, as a follow-up, so could there be the possibility, once you know those details, which I expect will happen well before 2026, which is when your next update will be, could there be an option to you to do another, let's say, midterm adjustment to your TDP to reflect whatever new funding you may be receiving, hopefully substantial, into this revised TDP?
Yes, that's absolutely possible. And in fact, every year we have to submit an annual progress report to the FDOT, and we'll make those revisions as we learn about the new financial environment that we find ourselves in. So with every year, we'll add a new 10th year to the financial plan.
Okay, CJ.
Yes, it's good to see the proposal for the express service on the previous I-95 between Port St. Lucie and West Palm Beach, and then also South Extension to come back. I cannot speak for other location, but at least from the between Port St. Lucie and Jupiter I work for, it's more convenient to get access to the transfer station on Turnpike because they have a park and ride facility. And is also the interchange was located on the more urbanized area. So it's closer, shorter distance to get access to. And I live in Palm City. It's almost impossible to get to the park and ride facility at the bus station at the next interchange, the entrance to the park, because there's no bridges, there's no the underground channel for me to go through that the I-95 interchange at the Palm City. So if it can run on the Turnpike and then utilizing the park and ride facility to that, I would certainly consider that commuting by bike.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Margie, do we have any public comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And then you do have one virtual hand raised, but I don't know if there's any other. I don't see any other 10 cards up.
Okay, who's the virtual hand?
It's Mo.
Oh, Mo.
Thank you. I have just one question for the presenter and maybe for Levi. I heard you bring up the park and ride study that is being done. Is this park and ride study is done in conjunction with the need to update the countywide PPM regarding the ride park and ride and its implication into the planning and zoning process and development approvals?
Yes. In fact, that was the impetus to the park and ride study.
Very good. Thank you. And one more follow-up question. So I saw that many of the projects that you had included the 561 plan core improvements, et cetera. So what type of improvements that we're speaking of and how they are tied up to some of the plans for like US-1 and Okeechobee and SR-7?
So we specifically considered increasing the frequency on the core network. So increasing that frequency to 15 minutes. And then, as I mentioned, there's some of the TSP projects. One of those I know is definitely on US-1, I think one on Okeechobee. So it's kind of an incremental progression towards the 561 plan.
Thank you. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mo. Thank you very much. Okay, the next item is Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7 Multimodal Corridor Study Update. I'd like to invite Jessica Jocelyn and Stuart Robertson, TPA consultants, to present this item.
Good morning. Now we're on. Good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here. I'm Jessica Jocelyn from Kittleson Associates here presenting also at Stuart Robertson at Kimley Horn to give you an update on how we're progressing with the Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7 multimodal corridor study. Stuart and I didn't, but James presented about this study back, I think it was in April or May. So it's been a little while since we've been back to you. So we wanted to just give a brief reminder of the study purpose. It's very much in alignment with what you've been discussing this morning, where we are evaluating Okeechobee and State Road 7 to look at pedestrian and bicycle needs, looking specifically and focused effort on transit service and enhancing the existing transit service. And we're also looking at supportive land uses and how that can play into the transportation decisions we're making, and ultimately looking to create a mode shift and more options for the population of Palm Beach County in this area and the growth that we're anticipating over time. This very much is in alignment with your 561 plan on creating a safe, efficient, and connected system throughout the county. Why Okeechobee and State Road 7? It's probably obvious to many of you in the room, but this corridor has many residents across it, looking at about 42,000 that could use a different type of system than what we have today. Also, there are a lot of jobs, 46,000 jobs in this area highlighted on the map. The limits are on State Road 7, starting at the Wellington Mall, and heading north to Okeechobee and going all the way east into downtown West Palm. So with that, I'm gonna pass it to Stuart, who's going to, with me, walk through some of the existing conditions that we found in the corridor.
And Jess and I are really gonna tag team this presentation. So we're just gonna go back and forth here because we are working very closely and integrating our teams together on the project. So crash data along the project corridor show that multimodal safety is an issue worthy of being addressed immediately. The heat map that is shown on this slide is from the TPA's pedestrian and bicycle safety study. It shows that the portion of the study corridor between the Turnpike and roughly Congress is one of the worst areas within the county for pedestrian crashes. The TPA's Vision Zero plan found a very similar outcome, and a review of crash data that we are conducting as part of the current Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7 study, data from Signal 4 Analytics show that this corridor is one of the few corridors that has actually more bicyclist crashes than it does pedestrian crashes, although the bicyclist crashes are more spread out than the pedestrian crashes are. Pedestrian crashes being more focused in that area between the Turnpike and Congress. Obviously, the existing transit conditions are a big part of our analysis, and we've been able to build from the work that PalmTran conducted as part of an Okeechobee Boulevard existing conditions assessment from January of 2021. This corridor, as it's drawn, is very important as it links two transit hubs from the mall at Wellington Green to the West Palm Beach Intermodal Center. Route 43 is the West Palm Beach crosstown route. That's a big part of our existing conditions assessment. It is not exactly analogous to the study corridor. There are portions of Okeechobee Boulevard that Route 43 does not serve. However, it is known to be one of PalmTran's most highly productive route in most of the monthly ridership assessments. So productive that during the course of this study, PalmTran has actually upgraded the service on Route 43 to now 20-minute headways instead of the 30 that it used to be.
And another important piece that we were able to, working with the TPA, incorporate into this corridor study that you don't often see in transportation studies is the impact on health. So how the decisions we make in infrastructure impacts the health of the community. So we wanted to make sure we showed under this existing conditions analysis, our assessment looking at data in terms of health disparities. So the health conditions of the population and communities within the corridor. And then also looking at an overall social vulnerability index. And the social vulnerability index takes into account communities' makeup in terms of housing and transportation costs, race, ethnicity, and language, social economic status, and also household composition. So what we intend to do with this existing data, and you can see where the vulnerability lies within this corridor, is as working with Stuart and his team in the TPA, we're going to assess again how the decisions we make looking at the different transportation alternatives impact the most vulnerable in the communities. And we'd like to try to eliminate or alleviate as much as possible any additional suffering for communities that already are at a potential disadvantage through the corridor. I also, before we get into the alternatives, we walk through the existing conditions analysis, but for those that maybe don't do corridor studies often, wanted to walk through the different components. And we've already alluded to some of this. So a major component of this study is the land use and economic development analysis. I am going to be later on in the presentation giving a bit of an example of what we mean by that and how it plays into our decision-making in this study. Stuart, as you heard, walk through the transit analysis under existing conditions, but he will also be walking you through future conditions and evaluation of alternatives. Roadway analysis was an equally important component of this study, knowing that the roadway makes up all the different modes, so we want to make sure we capture that in our analysis. As I just mentioned, the health impact assessment is an important study component in how we're impacting health in our decisions. And then very big throughout the whole project is public and stakeholder engagement. I want to thank many of you on this committee have been involved in this process. We've had stakeholder interviews, we have a technical committee, and we have workshops. We've already held one that I'm going to walk through, and we have one coming up as well. So the public workshop that we held, it was August 19th through November 12th. It was in person on the 19th and then virtual through November 12th. This first workshop really focused on engaging with the community on what they observe and find the issues and opportunities to be from the mall, Wellington Mall, all the way to downtown West Palm. We had over 40 people in person, and of course, with the pandemic going on, we had safety measures and protocol in place for that, but it was great to see 40 or so people visit. On the workshop, we've had over 1,300 views and 508 of them unique. So we are seeing repeat customers, if you will, come to the workshop and see what's going on and give us their feedback, which is great. There is a survey as part of the workshop, and we had 809 survey visits, 236 completed. So we're getting lots of feedback from the community. In addition to the survey, we also had an interactive map. You may have seen or visited it yourself, where people could drop a note and tell us lots of different things, really anything they wanted to. So we might even have some information to share at the end of this with the municipalities and county for anything that's not to be covered in this study. And then you can see the laundry list. Working with Melissa, Cassidy, and James, they've done an excellent job. Really, everything's on the table in terms of getting the word out and getting feedback from folks. So as a result of all of that interaction, these were the top three priorities we heard from the community: congestion relief, health and safety, and mobility choices. So it was really great to see that synergy and alignment with what the TPA is already trying to achieve and what we anticipated going into this study as being the needs moving forward.
It's not surprising from the results of the public survey that congestion relief would rank so highly, because the baseline traffic inventory that we are conducting as part of this study, which is typical with the level of detail that is found in an alternatives analysis phase for a transit study. The baseline traffic inventory shows that the corridor handles a high volume of people traveling in cars. The base traffic volumes range from 42,000 AADT on State Road 7 between Belvedere and Okeechobee, which incidentally is the only six-lane segment of the corridor. The entire rest, other than that 1 mile, is eight lanes in typical section. Ranging from 42,000 up to 77,000, Okeechobee carries between I-95 and Tamarind. With that level of traffic volume, there is a lot of traffic capacity. I mentioned most of the corridor is eight lanes. So in the base, as well as several segments in the LRTP horizon year, it's currently projected to operate either at level service C or D. In the peak hour segment analysis, there are a few additional segments in the 2045 that are projected to operate at LOSF. In fact, the whole segment from State Road 7 to Military Trail falls in that because volumes are projected to increase into the high 70,000s if we do nothing else other than build what's in currently in the cost feasible plan. So we established a series of goals and objectives to guide the evaluation of alternatives in the study. The first goal is to allocate roadway space appropriately for all users of the corridor, non-motorized transit users, single occupancy vehicles as well. And then we established four kind of evaluation metrics associated with that goal, and another four metrics associated with the goal of maximizing return on any investment in enhanced transit service within the area. So this second goal is where we get into things like linking to the major activity centers, the investment in promoting redevelopment and transit supportive forms of development in the future along the corridor. Just referenced that earlier. We'll see some slides toward the end of the presentation specific to that. The next series of slides show each of the seven alternatives that are currently under consideration one by one. There are many different typical sections along the corridor. I'm going to show the section of Okeechobee Boulevard between State Road 7 and Jog Road as an example. So we'll see that segment, Okeechobee from State Road 7 to Jog, one after the other, so you can compare the various alternatives. First one is the no build or no action alternative. This one would leave the corridor currently as it is today, which is four lanes in each direction, 12-foot wide travel lanes, each of the eight lanes are, and a 5-foot bicycle lane. I think it actually ranges from 4 to 5, which, although it was standard at the time it was built, is currently substandard for bicycle facilities on the state highway system. There's also a continuous 6-foot sidewalk throughout this segment of the corridor. So when we compare to our goals, we see that really none of the metrics are met by the no build, no action condition. So each one of the alternatives will sort of progress in terms of its level of investment. Starting with alternative two, this is a mixed traffic bus with limited stop service. So this alternative includes having traffic, a transit bus operating in mixed traffic in the outside lane. Limited stop service just means maybe we would go to one stop every mile or two or something like that. It would be an overlay on top of the current Route 43 service, because limited stop service by itself is not adequate to entirely serve the needs of people riding in transit because of the frequency of stops. So while this does address providing safe facilities for vulnerable users and having the ability to provide amenities and transit stops and major activity centers, it doesn't address some of the other evaluation criteria that we have. One thing you will notice, though, is we've provided a little bit of a tweak in the travel lane widths here in order to accomplish a buffered bicycle lane along the corridor, and also provided a 12-foot multimodal path on both sides of the roadway. That's going to be common in each one of the build alternatives that I'm walking through, which will be to reconstruct the existing 6-foot sidewalk into a 12-foot multimodal path in order to try to meet that goal of providing safe and separated facilities for our multimodal travelers on the corridor. Alternative three is our business access and transit, or BAT lanes alternative. This is a roadway configuration where the transit vehicles would have preferential use to the outside lane. The use of the outside lane could also include people making turns from the corridor, or hence accessing businesses. That's where the BA and the BAT lane acronym does come from. A lot of the corridor has dedicated right turn lanes. And so in that type of a configuration, the use of the right lane would be for merging across the BAT lane into the right lane. But in more constrained areas of the corridor, in particular east of the turnpike, that BAT lane would be crucial for allowing motorists to be able to turn right onto side streets or into businesses. Also buffered bike lane, as well as the 12-foot multimodal paths on both sides of the roadway as part of this alternative. The next three alternatives are going to be dedicated lane alternatives. The first of which is a curbside dedicated bus rapid transit lane. In this alternative, the transit has exclusive access rather than just preferential, but exclusive access to the right turn lane. So this would be a lane repurposing alternative. It meets most of the criteria that we're evaluating as part of our evaluation, with the exception of minimizing travel time and delay for all users. So although it's faster for transit users, it does come with what we think would be about a 15 to 20% additional travel time for motorists, because the lanes would be going from 8 lanes to 6 lanes from the perspective of the single occupant vehicles. The next alternative is similar, but it's a center platform dedicated bus rapid transit. So this would be an exclusive 2-lane road in the median of Okeechobee Boulevard where the transit routes would operate. So the access to these to the transit service would be through center platform stations in the median of the roadway. And we also expand the road in this case to include protected bike lanes as well as the multimodal pathway. This level of investment would likely incur a more reconstruction scope of the roadway rather than just the resurfacing scope that we saw in some of the previous alternatives. Then alternative six is similar, except we're looking at light rail transit instead of bus rapid transit. So this is one of two rail options that we are looking at. The geometry is similar, except the transit technology is different. One thing to note about these two center platform alternatives, in addition to a reduction in through lanes from 8 to 6, there would be impacts to the signal operations as well. Likely some of the intersections that currently have dual left turn lanes would be redesigned as single, unless the right-of-way were to allow them to still have two left turn lanes. That's probably true more in the western part of the corridor, but in the eastern part of the corridor would likely be looking at single left turn lanes. This is similar to some of the pier facilities that we're reviewing from around the country that have implemented center platform transit, either bus rapid or light rail. Then the final alternative is elevated grade separated, LRT. So this is the only one that meets all of the evaluation criteria, although it does come with some additional, lots of additional construction costs, some additional time for implementation that would be required. It's by far the highest level of investment. And you can see that on the next slide of the presentation, which looks at our initial conceptual alternatives evaluation. On the far right of this evaluation slide is our estimated total capital cost. You can see the no bill being zero in the upper right-hand corner of this table. And then you go from there reading downward with the likely construction costs for each one of the alternatives. For comparison purposes, the elevated grade separated LRT obviously is the highest. It's about 25 times higher than the least level investment, which would be the mixed traffic with limited stops. Some of the other evaluation criteria that we're looking at here include annual operations and maintenance costs. And so the baseline there is the 2.7 annual operations and maintenance costs that's estimated to continue operating the transit service as it exists today. And then you can see the comparison to the various alternatives, roughly $4 to $5 million for some of the lighter infrastructure bus alternatives, and up to higher than in some cases $10 million for some of the more more robust transit options. Weekday estimated ridership is also provided here. Obviously, the less investment, it's very likely that we'll have less of an impact on ridership. In fact, the mixed traffic bus may not have much impact on ridership at all. It would be it would be trying to entice some additional ridership by the travel time that benefits that are afforded to a mixed traffic bus when compared to the existing ridership. We're providing a range here because the level of detail that we have at this stage of the game, it's only really appropriate to provide a range of anticipated ridership. These numbers do account for changes in the automobile travel time for the dedicated lane options 4, 5, and 6. They also account for the implementation of first last mile solutions through micro transit, which could be a circulator on-demand type of service that would provide connections into surrounding neighborhoods in order to try to provide first last mile and door-to-door service through this transit service. The other thing with travel time, that's kind of the column in the center of the table here, travel time is important because that's probably the metric that really it motivates a lot of ridership, at least from the model standpoint, and that does seem to be borne out by passenger surveys as well. So travel time ranging from, in the no-build conditions, more than 50 minutes for the trip service on travel time, down to the fastest, which would be the elevated grade separated. That's the only one that's completely grade separated, down to about 27 minutes. For comparison purposes, the trip by automobile from Wellington Mall to downtown West Palm Beach, depending on level of traffic congestion, depending on whether it's, you know, free flow conditions, is probably somewhere between 28 and 40 minutes today. So that's just provided as a point of comparison to the data that you're seeing here in the travel time evaluation. The proposed station locations, we have kept them constant for evaluation purposes and ridership to kind of provide an equal analysis. There are 17 proposed station locations along the 13.5 mile journey of the corridor from Wellington to downtown West Palm. Now I'll hand it back to Jess.
So that's a great segue into the land use discussion. So how does infrastructure and land use work together? I know I'm preaching to the choir a bit here, and many of you probably know this, but we just wanted to make sure we didn't skip over this and assume everyone knows. But it's a very important piece of this corridor study, especially given the transit element. So here we have an example of Meisner Park in Boca. You see the adjacent rail and the new Brightline station at $46 million investment expected to open in 2022. So we thought this was a good example to share because it really shows what you do with your land can bring economic incentives to the municipality and county. So here we look at it in a bit of a different way and look at value per acre of Meisner. So we have a couple call outs here of the value per acre in Meisner ranging from 48 million to almost 11 million. And in the bottom left, it's very hard to see, but in comparison, Walmart is under $1 million per acre. So as you can see, your value per acre really changes in how you develop, and that can really make more opportunities for a city or county how you develop your land. So we took that example from Meisner and kind of dropped it in, and this is just for theory. We're not actually proposing Meisner Park be directly built in this area, but this is the intersection of State Road 7 and Okeechobee. So north to orient you is to the right of the screen. So this is an undeveloped piece of land right now. So the taxable value of this property in the southeast quadrant of Okeechobee and State Road 7, the area is getting $0 in taxable value with it not being developed. Now in the future, there's an overlay for this area to be mixed use. So by taking this Meisner example and putting it here, you can have a value of about $11 million per acre. So that's a great incentive as we change our transportation and this redevelopment comes, as you all know, it really can provide opportunities for the jurisdiction in the area. So now that land use piece is completed, I did, before going to next steps, want to share that we do have a land use and economic development group that we're working with. So if you want to have more detail on that, we're happy to share those meeting notes with you and findings. In terms of next steps and closing of our presentation today, we are going to continue moving forward with the technical analysis on the transit and roadway pieces that Stuart walked through. We're moving forward on the health impact assessment as well and figuring out how to best incorporate that into the decision-making process and continuing to move forward with that land use assessment as we get to closer to a preferred alternative, looking specifically at opportunities for low, medium, and high potential redevelopment opportunities along the stations. For recent and upcoming meetings, we had a health impact meeting yesterday, the 30th. Really, I wanna highlight, most importantly from this slide, that we have a second workshop happening that's going to be asking folks to give their opinions on the alternatives. So a very, very important workshop. It will be only virtual this time, starting on December 4th, and I believe we'll have it open for about a month. So you have plenty of time to go in. Very much encourage you to take that. Or go to that workshop and take the survey within it and share it with others. We have more meetings occurring in January and February with the steering committee and the land use and health groups. But most importantly to this group, other than the workshop coming, is that we will be coming in March with final recommendations. So Stuart walked through a lot of alternatives. So how we narrow down to a preferred alternative and what that looks like will be coming to you and your board in March. So we'll be looking for an action at that time. But for today, we'd love to just get your reaction. This is a lot of information. We've been working on it since the spring. So any questions, comments, Stuart and I are happy to take those now and incorporate them into the study as best possible.
Thank you very much. Staff, are there any public comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, I see Alex has his.
I just want to make it quick because I know it's late, but I kind of want to repeat a general comment that I made at the meeting that we had a few weeks ago. This is with regards to the different alternatives. As Stuart has pointed out in the past, there's a number of different existing cross sections in this corridor. You have basically State Road 7 and then the western portions of Okeechobee Boulevard that are fairly different from the eastern portions of Okeechobee. So west of the turnpike and east of the turnpike, I mean, and I know even east of the turnpike, there's several different cross sections. The existing cross section and some of the proposals that you showed tend to resemble more of the western portion of the corridor, in which there's more space, there are more options for accommodating some of these different options, whether it's biking, whether it's expanding sidewalks, or even accommodating some of the transit options. The further east you move, it gets more challenging, there's less space. So I do believe that in these meetings that you're gonna have over the next few weeks, when the public or stakeholders are being asked to provide some their opinions on the different options, that we should also have, again, other graphics also showing what the different options or alternatives would look like in the more easterly portions of the corridor. Because I haven't seen them, but I presume that some of the cross sections that you are showing
may not be feasible in some of those areas because of lack of space. So for people to have a much better perspective as to what it is that they are providing input on, they may want to have, again, kind of a multiple views of what that option would look like, depending upon in which section of the corridor they're located. So that would be kind of my main feedback, especially as you start to seek recommendations or suggestions on which alternatives people would like to see.
Yeah, it's a great point Alex is making. And just to add a little bit of color commentary there, east of the turnpike, we have an 8-lane roadway in 130 feet of right-of-way. FDOT standard for a 6-lane road is 130 feet of right-of-way, or 126, I think it is. So that's two extra lanes in 4 extra feet. Obviously, the math doesn't work. So it's a very constrained segment already. Most of that segment of Okeechobee Boulevard today, the border width standards, FDOT's border width standards are substandard in that area. We don't have enough space adjacent to the roadway to accommodate the clear zone, the sidewalk width, the things that we would want to see there. So we do have the typical sections for that area. They are somewhat more confined, but in particular, the lane repurposing one is maintained through the entire corridor. If there's a curbside BRT or a center platform BRT, it's a continuous alternative throughout the corridor. Yeah. Yes, we do. We have a bike lane proposed and I think an 8-foot sidewalk in that area, but the bike lane is continuous throughout all the segments too. Yeah, thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Alex. Maria?
Sorry. I had a question. I was just wondering the health disparities that you have in there is a heat map that you presented, and I was wondering what is the meaning and how do you get the information? I'm not sure what it really displays here.
That's an excellent question. So the data is publicly available in terms of the health conditions, asthma, cancer, things of that nature. And I forget the unit because I know we changed it quite a bit, but I believe it's down to the track that we assess the data for the different health conditions and then created the light to dark color to see where health conditions are suffering the most in comparison to the whole area. But I'm happy to share additional details on that with you if you wanted to have further information.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Good question.
All right. It's almost noon, CJ.
Very polite.
Make sure I will be done quickly. I would like to see the ridership forecast for each alternative after the LRT or whatever the BRT is done. And I get to relate it to the next information I'm looking for is the benefit to the cost ratio for each event. And then the third is kind of question, when you remove one of the turn lane, the for the left turn because of the dedicated right away for the LRT in the medium, is it still sufficient to accommodate the future growth of the traffic?
The we're currently, you know, as part of the evaluation phase, working on developing a productivity metric that would look at comparing the ridership to the operating cost, as well as what the capital impacts on the project would be. In terms of its schedule. As for the intersection analysis, at this phase of a study, we're not doing micro simulation studies or VISM or anything like that. It's very likely that if this project were to advance to PD&E, that level of detail would be included at that time. But in the alternatives analysis phase, we're not looking in at that level of detail. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I've been told that the last two items on the agenda, C and D, are not time sensitive.
Oh, you do have Terrence. And then, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, you do have two virtual.
Oh, okay.
Jim and Mo.
I'm sorry, Terrence.
Oh, no, thank you. If you could go back to the typical sections, specifically the one that had six travel lanes and the dedicated transit lane on the outside. I did have a question as specifically if improving in the median is an option, whether it be transit, elevated, why wasn't adding a new travel lane in the center to maintain four lanes in each direction, maintaining our current level of service, and adding the dedicated transit lane on the outside with pedestrians evaluated as a potential typical section? Basically, this typical with two more lanes in the middle, since now the middle is an option for use. Also, I'm heavily in favor of that dedicated transit lane on the outside acting as a soft buffer for bicycles, because if there's not going to be a vehicle except when there's a bus in that lane, it's a lot safer, to Alex's point for the last 5 years, of you'll feel safe riding on the road when there's not a car always next to you, when it's intermittent with that bus. So that is a great soft buffer, not buffer that we title it, but as a way to feel better when you ride. But my question is basically, why does this typical not have two more lanes in the middle?
I think the primary reason there is because when we add two lanes as a bus alternative, we separate those using concrete separators. So it's basically its own little road in the middle of the median. But if we were to build conventional travel lanes there, we would have to have a double yellow stripe separating the two directions of traffic. And that would not provide the type of median separation that we would want from the opposing directions of traffic. So when it's a bus alternative, we create them as two separate lanes. The cars can't get in there. If they were to be general purpose travel lanes, we wouldn't be able to provide that level of separation.
But you could, if you, again, in other alternatives, you don't have 12 foot lanes. I mean, again, we're talking about maybe 11 to 11 and a half foot lanes. That would give you the 4 or 5 feet you need in the middle for a raised separator, concrete median that's required. And you could get four lanes plus the bus, plus the bikes in basically the same dimension that you have. Mm-hmm. My question is, was it thoroughly evaluated? Because if you could fit light rail in the middle, I find it hard to believe we can't figure out how to get two more lanes in the middle to maintain four lanes of service in this corridor. Okay, but how do you get light rail to work if you can figure out how the light rail works in the middle? I don't understand why we can't get regular travel lanes to work in the middle.
The DOT standard median, I think, is 22 feet. So 23 is right at the standard median. There are some constrained options that allow us to go down to 15 in some situations. Below that, it changes the access class of the road. 5-lane, 2-way left turn lane center roadway is certainly an option, but not one that we're considering for this segment of Okeechobee Boulevard, which really is built more in a suburban type style. So I think it's the median standards that we're maintaining with the bus rapid transit and the light rail transit in the median that we would not be able to maintain if they were general purpose travel lanes with a double yellow separating the direction of traffic.
Okay.
Terrence, you're good? So I have...
Okay. Sorry, my parking's about to expire.
I have Jim and Mo.
Okay, Jim?
Yes. Trying to get my video to work. Okay. I was just wondering if any in the alternatives, if the possibility for shade trees is going to be an option. There obviously are transit stops out there and shelters out there currently, but a lot of them are just mostly stops, and so there's no shade for any passengers that want to ride the transit. And I think this would also help out, you know, the goal of the health, improving the health index that was mentioned earlier, and also the heat. There's obviously heat factors now, and South Florida heat is getting worse. So I just wondered if there's any consideration to be for shade trees in the swales, if we can do that. Thank you.
Yes, and we have gotten that feedback through the health impact assessment phase of the project as well. It's likely that could be incorporated during the design phase of the project specific to the enhanced station areas for any of the transit options, but in particular, a BRT or an LRT option would likely have the level of investment that would provide for either artificial or natural forms of shade to be incorporated around the transit stops.
Okay, I'm sorry, who was the last? Mo?
Yeah, thank you. I hear you, and I know it's too late, so I'm not gonna be talking about all my points. I have too many of them, but I know that the design team and the research team have heard my opinion on this before. So I'm gonna be touching up on just a couple or three of the items that I believe are key here. One of them is my concern with the ridership and the way the ridership is calculated. I said this before, and our experience had been a knowledge of this corridor is that there is probably small, very small percentage of trips along this corridor that start and end within the same corridor. Remember, especially if you talk about Okeechobee Boulevard, it is a huge thoroughfare that goes east-west, connects all the Midwestern central communities to the rest of the county and outside of the county. And so you have huge volumes of traffic that go into and coming out from the two plazas at the I-95 and on Turnpike. So all of those, and you have a lot of traffic that comes from the west going east on Okeechobee Boulevard and vice versa. All of these, and also from the north, the Indian Chief District and the acreage, as we call it, they all come on Okeechobee from the west and or come on SR7 extension from the north. And none of those trips are starting and ending along this corridor. So I don't understand how can this be factored into your calculation of the ridership for the mass transit. You are providing a fixed route, you know, along, you know, a limited corridor, and you expect, you know, you will pick up those tens of thousands of trips that you have listed in the study. So this is one important point I want to bring up. And that's why I'm like CJ, I would love to see your ridership numbers when you are ready and for each of the modes, the alternatives, and some justification on how it was calculated and arrived at. The other thing is the level of service. I saw that you had said somewhere in the presentation that the level of service along this corridor is between C and D. Maybe C and D for most part of Okeechobee, but not for SR7, certainly. And if you disagree with me, I want you to ask any person who drives on SR7, you know, passing through the intersection or the interchange with SR80. Also, I want you to ask every single person who goes to downtown West Palm Beach in the morning and tell me if they will agree with you that the level of service between I-95 and Parker or slash Tamarind is anything but F, okay? And it seems like, you know, conveniently the level of service and determination of level of service for different segments was based on just daily volumes and that's it. We have also huge issues with level of service and congestion along this corridor now in the segment between the Turnpike all the way east to almost I-95. Much of the factors that you need to be considered when you do this evaluation are access management, length of storage lanes, spillovers, which are all over the place in that segment. So I want also to bring this up. And I saw that somewhere you mentioned that Okeechobee Boulevard between I-95 and Australian is free flow. And probably that's how you decided that, okay, the level of service is A or B, because you use the capacity for free flow, eight lanes divided. However, this is not quite that. You understand that there's a lane drop eastbound at Australian Avenue, and then that reopens with the receiving free northbound ride into Okeechobee from Australian. So that by itself disrupts it. That segment in particular is awful. It's failing all the time. I always receive phone calls from everybody complaining about traffic there. So it cannot be level of service C or D. The other thing is that you mentioned in the study, one of the goals is to look for the alternative that will give you the best travel time. But at the end of the day, we find that, you know, troubling to me that very often when we're dealing with the TPA and the staff and et cetera about, you know, goals and means, that there is always a huge mix up between goals and means. We make means our goals. And so we want multimodalism at any price and any cost. We want, you know, certain things at any cost. This is not, you know, the way you do it. This cannot be your goal. Our goal always is safety. Number two, travel time reduction, minimization, travel time reliability. You tell me about, so all of these need to be factored in, and you say that they are factored in. I do not see them in your evaluation metrics. I don't see anywhere in your evaluation metrics between the alternatives, the true cost of travel time. This is very important, and I made this point before. It's very important for you to calculate the travel time for the do nothing alternative, then and do it for each one of the other alternatives. And why I say travel time for everybody. If you assert that you will be dedicating a lane of travel in each direction to buses only, you need to make certain realistic assumptions of how much, how many travelers it will carry and through, and substitute for that lost capacity and calculate travel time for everybody else, or all of them together. And that should be major, you know, metric, because that will show which alternative is better than the other alternatives, because travel time is cost. And you know that very well, that, you know, that's how we do it in transportation industry. When we determine the benefits of any transportation facility, we look at the benefit it provides. The benefits usually are what? They are travel time savings, because that's money, that's people's money, time. So I'm hoping that this will be included again as a metric, so that when the board or anybody else will make their minds on any of the alternatives offered, they will have a full picture of what are the consequences of the thing that they are, the alternative that they are voting for or considering or supporting. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mo.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate Mo's input very much. And certainly the model that we're using for ridership analysis is FTA stops model. It does include a park and ride component. So it will estimate the amount of ridership it thinks that the alternatives could pick up from park and ride. And we, at four particular locations along the corridor, we included a possibility for park and ride. One of the key ones was at the intersection of Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7, where there is the potential to incorporate a mixed use development on the southeast corner of that intersection, which may have a park and ride component built into it. This is all, of course, future planning. There's nothing on the table that would show that, but in terms of providing a transportation alternative that would be supportive of that type of development, we have looked at that. And the level of service, absolutely, we're just looking at the segment level service, not a detailed micro simulation of every intersection. We're fully aware of the bottlenecks that exist along the corridor, like Mo mentioned, at in particular coming into downtown at Tamarind, especially if the train gates goes down. You know, in Okeechobee coming into downtown, that's definitely a major bottleneck and a source of traffic queuing along that segment of the corridor. So, yeah, we're continuing to refine our analysis, looking at the productivity of the routes. And I very much appreciate the input from Mo and all the committee members here today as we move forward.
Great. Thank you. Do I need to take a motion? Changing those items,
you don't have a quorum, so anymore. If there's a consensus of the members still present, we can defer items C and D to the February meeting.
Move to adjourn.
Okay. All right. Next meeting, February.